What is the difference between gifts and graces? Gifts are usually unconditional in that they're given to God at birth, at least natural gifts. They form part of our personality, and we can't really take credit for them. You're sort of born with them, aren't we? Those natural, some people just have good hand-eye coordination. Some people are just mechanically minded. Some people are born with an artistic ability. Those are gifts. But graces are unnatural. You're not born with them. You have to be born again. And the Holy Spirit has to nurture these within your lives. You can think of the fruits of the Spirit, which the Spirit causes within us. So as we come to Jephthah, as we carry on through our study in the Judges, we've already noted that Jephthah, he is a mafia boss. He's like a godfather figure who's become a leader in Israel. And we're looking at a man who has gifts. He's got gifts in leadership. He's got gifts in battle. He's got gifts in administration. But he doesn't have graces. He doesn't have character. He doesn't have godliness. And that's what we see is lacking in him. By this, we're reminded that not all good leaders are good people. Some people are great politicians, but bad Christians. So Israel is in desperate need for someone to lead their armies. Ammon have invaded their land. They're demanding that the land is given back. And so they have scraped the bottom of the barrel for someone who can help them fight against the Ammonites. And so Jephthah is the choice of Israel. This reminds us of the many times that churches have called leaders not because of their faithfulness, not because of their holiness, but because of their apparent gifts, charms, and ability to get results. You know, we want a guy who can fill the room rather than a man who is faithful. We will observe the results of this choice as we watch Jephthah encounter the Ammonites. What we will see is gifts, but no graces. Those things that he had at birth, but not what he has cultivated in holiness. So three things we'll be pointing out as we go through Jephthah's reign here. We want to look at his politics. We want to look at his parenting. And we want to look at his peacekeeping. Let's begin with his politics. Just to set the scene, you'll remember that the Ammonites have made an aggressive move, which has prompted Israel to find a leader to fight them off. So look down. This is where the narrative picks up. Jephthah is now addressing this matter. Here he is. This is the job he's been chosen for. And he begins to do his job, verses 12 and 13. Then Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the Ammonites and said, "What do you have against me that you have come to me to fight against my land?" And the king of the Ammonites answered the messengers of Jephthah, "Because Israel, on coming up from Egypt, took away my land from the Arnon to the Jabbok and to the Jordan. Now therefore, restore it peaceably." So there you see Jephthah and the Ammonites. So here is Jephthah, a newly minted leader, speaking disturbingly of my and me with regards to the land. And he enters into negotiations with these invaders. The Ammonites, though, say that they have a claim, because the land has wrongfully been taken from them when Israel came out of Egypt, which would have been about 300 years before this. And now they're demanding that peaceful restoration. Now this interaction, especially as it's stated, would be typical of the times. There's a lot of the usual political posturing going on in this exchange. But there is a lie. The land never belonged to Ammon. Don't know if you noticed that as we were reading through it. It wasn't the Ammonites, but it was the Amorites that were mentioned throughout the historical exchange. So Jephthah, continuing to pursue a political solution, he's still entering into negotiations with the Ammonites. This is where we see his skill as a politician, as he tries to spar, as it were, with the Ammonites. And as we look at his response, there are a number of arguments that he makes. These have been described as his historical argument, his theological argument, his personal argument, and his chronological argument. Now, before we dig in here, Let's just speak about the elephant in the room. Jephthah, in Hebrews 11, verse 32, is described as a man of faith. Ordinarily, when we look at Hebrews 11, we see those, I've heard people preach sermons on the heroes of the faith. You know, lauding these incredible people who did such incredible things. And so Hebrews 11, verse 32, describes Jephthah as someone who did things by faith. Will Jephthah be in heaven with us one day? Well, based on that description in Hebrews 11, we'd have to say yes. Does this mean that everything in Jephthah's life is commendable? Well, we're going to see that definitely is not. So if there is a section where the faith of Jephthah is put on display, it's going to be this first section. Here, as he rehearses accurately the biblical account of how God brought the people out of the land of Israel and testifies to what God did on behalf of his people, crediting God with all of these miraculous works, that must be where we credit his faith. In fact, as we look at Hebrews 11, verse 34, it talks in this list of men that are noted for their faith, it mentions those who drove away foreign armies by faith. So that's probably specifically referring to Jephthah. So where is Jephthah's faith relevant? It's in how he fought, how he trusted in the Lord, in the Lord's battles, as he fought for the Lord's people. Okay? So was Jephthah a man of faith? Yes. Okay? And it's this first part where we can probably tick that box, but then later on it all becomes circumspect. So we won't be able to credit him with faith when he ends up sacrificing his daughter. So let's look now at the parts of his argument. Firstly, the historical argument. Jephthah will highlight how Israel sought, remember Israel leaves Egypt, and they move into this promised land, they move into this particular area under dispute. And what was Israel's modus operandi? Did they just rush around with swords and start chopping heads off people, or did they enter into diplomacy? Did they ask for permission? That's exactly what happened. So, let's note. Verses 14 to 17. Jephthah again sent messengers to the king of the Ammonites and said to him, "Thus says Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab or the land of the Ammonites, but when they came up from Egypt, Israel went through the wilderness to the Red Sea and came to Kadesh. Israel then sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, 'Please let us pass through your land.' But the king of Edom would not listen. And they sent also to the king of Moab, but he would not consent. So Israel remained at Kadesh." He then points out that Moab was the aggressor, not Israel, and that Moab lost the land in war. And he concludes that the land was not Ammonite land, but Amorite land. Look at verses 18 to 22. "Then they journeyed through the wilderness and went around the land of Edom and the land of Moab and arrived on the east side of the land of Moab and camped on the other side of the Arnon." Does this sound like warmongering people when they're actually trying to avoid conflict by going or taking the long way around? So you can see how he's just helping them, sort of setting the tone for who is the real warmonger in the situation. "But they did not enter the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was the boundary of Moab. Israel then sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, king of Heshbon. And Israel said to him, 'Please let us pass through your land to our country.' But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people together and encamped at Jahaz and fought with Israel. And the Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated them. So Israel took possession of all the land of the Amorites who inhabited that country. And they took possession of all the territory of the Amorites from the Arnon to the Jabbok and from the wilderness to the Jordan." So, who's lying in this situation? Obviously the Ammonites. Okay. They're just claiming that this was once their land. Wrong. So, let's look at the theological argument, verses 23 and 24. Here we see that it is Yahweh who is the one who gave the land to Israel. "So then the Lord, the God of Israel, dispossessed the Amorites from before his people Israel. And are you to take possession of them? Will you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? And all that the Lord our God has dispossessed before us, we will possess." So now he's talking about the gods. There's a little bit of mockery here. There's a little bit of jibing thrown in. And there's sort of a technical point here. Technically, Chemosh was the god of the Amorites, not the Ammonites. Milcom was the god of the Ammonites. But, and this is possibly why it's a jab, is Jephthah saying, well, you know, most of the ancient peoples would have conceived gods as territorial gods. So that's Chemosh's domain, and that's Milcom's domain, and Yahweh was thought to be the god of the mountains. Outsiders thought of Yahweh as the god of the high places because of Sinai. And so each one had their territories. And so when one army from this territory went to fight another army of that territory, this god from this territory was beating that god of that territory. And it was seen as a sort of the war of the gods. Whoever's god was strongest would own the territory. Okay? So this is what's all in the background of these comments. And so Jephthah is probably saying, well, you know, the god of this territory is not Milcom, it's Chemosh. And won't your god Chemosh, who's not really your god, give you this land? So you can see there's a little bit of jibing going on here. But Jephthah's faith is clear. He is crediting Yahweh with giving the land through victory. Now, next we have the personal argument, where Jephthah asks whether Ammon is stupider than Balak. You remember Balak? He tried to hire the prophet Balaam to curse Israel so that he can go and fight him and beat him. And in Numbers 22 and following, and he couldn't do it. Over and over, he tried to get Balaam to curse Israel so that he could then win a battle against him, but he couldn't. And so what did Balak end up doing? He withdrew. He did not pursue war. He actually just left. He was clever enough not to fight. And so now Jephthah's saying, are you better than Balak? Are you stronger and wiser than him? The final argument is the historical one. If the land was really yours, why did you not claim it 300 years ago? The chronological argument. So if you were so worried about this land, and here we are 300 years later, why didn't you come earlier? Think of verse 26. While Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, and in Aroer and its villages, and in all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon, 300 years, why did you not deliver them within that time? And so Jephthah then draws it all to a conclusion, stating that it is not Israel that has sinned, but Ammon. And he calls upon God to be the judge in this situation. Verse 27. I therefore have not sinned against you, and you do me wrong by making war on me. The Lord, the judge, decide this day between the people of Israel and the people of Ammon. And Ammon, of course, do not listen. Verse 28. But the king of the Ammonites did not listen to the words of Jephthah that he sent to him. So far, so good. Is Jephthah sounding like a pretty good guy? Does he sound like a guy who's got some good biblical knowledge? I mean, here is a guy who's he's not ignorant. He can actually really recite what went on in the book of Exodus and in the book of Numbers. You know, this is pretty detailed. It's almost hopeful that maybe they chose the right man for the job. I mean, here's a guy who's he seems to really have it all together in his mind. He can bring a good argument to bear. And so this leads to war, and it's then at this point that Jephthah's character begins to show. His terrible parenting is put in the foreground. So look at verse 29. Then the Spirit of the Lord was upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh and passed on to Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed on to the Ammonites. So we see here that the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. But that's not saying he was a Christian. That's not saying he was a believer. The Spirit of the Lord came upon a donkey to cause it to speak. The Spirit of the Lord would often come upon someone for a particular task or purpose. It's not necessarily a statement of their spiritual standing. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Saul as well in the same way. We see him going through several areas, probably gathering forces. Now, here we have to stop and ask ourselves the question, what would we expect after this? You know, if you see a statement that says, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and then he. What would you expect to see issuing forth from a man who's been described as the Spirit of the Lord coming upon him? You'd expect, hopefully, to hear about the fruits of the Spirit or some wonderful, you know, godliness springing forth. But that's not what we see. Instead, we have the vow. Look at verse 30 to 31. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, If you will give the Ammonites into my hand, Then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's. And I will offer it up for a burnt offering. In other words, a whole burnt offering. Now, there's much that's faulty with this vow. Firstly, the vow lacks an understanding of grace and seeks to buy a victory with some negotiation. Look at the if-then-I language. If you do this for me, then I will do this for you. It betrays that Jephthah does not have a proper understanding of God's grace, and he seeks to secure the blessing. So he's not treating God like God. He's treating God a little bit more like the Canaanites would treat their idols. So there seems to be something off in the way in which he's negotiating here. No doubt there was a lot riding on this victory for Jephthah. This is his, you know, initial performance review. If he doesn't get it right this time, you know, he probably won't have his position of power for very long. You know, there's a lot riding on this. So he's negotiating for a win. But secondly, we also see a lack of faith. If the Spirit was upon him, we would imagine that he would have been taught to believe that God can win the day, that he would grant him courage and boldness. But rather, we see Jephthah bartering for victory instead of trusting. And thirdly, the nature of the vow itself is contrary to the law of God. Deuteronomy 12, verse 31 says, You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abominable thing that the Lord hates, they have done for their gods, for they even burn their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods. So that's a clear commandment in the law of God. Don't worship me like they worship their gods. And yet it is very clear that Jephthah is entertaining this possibility, treating God like a Canaanite deity. Some have tried to defend Jephthah. Some have tried to give him the benefit of the doubt. Some have tried to say one of two options. Jephthah was anticipating that there would be an animal that would come out of the gates, and he was actually visualizing an animal when he said these words. Does that make sense? It doesn't make sense, because once his daughter came out, he would have carried on looking. Where's the animal? Where's the animal? He would have carried on looking until an animal arrived, but he didn't. As soon as his daughter came, dutiful daughter, celebrating her dad's victory, rushing out to be the first to congratulate him, he took her as the one. The second option that people have tried to suggest is that there was some, much like Samuel was set aside as a Nazarite, maybe there was a female cloister of Nazaritesses, you know, and she was dedicated to a female cloister of Nazaritesses. And he didn't actually burn her to death. He gave her to a consecrated life of Old Testament version of nunnery. But we'll see that that's not the case either. He portrays that he conceives of God in a Canaanite fashion. Perhaps he's even misunderstanding God on the basis of Abraham, who sacrificed Isaac. Maybe he's wrongly appropriating that story because he doesn't understand what's going on there. There, with regards to Abraham and Isaac, God was providing a redemptive analogy that points to not to us sacrificing our children as an example, but showing us what God is willing to do to save guilty sinners. Well, we see that victory is given in battle, and there's only two verses for the victory, because this isn't the main thing. Look at verse 32 and 33. So Jephthah crossed over to the Ammonites to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand, and he struck them from Aroer to the neighborhood of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel-Keramim, with a great blow. So the Ammonites were subdued before the people of Israel. That's it. Ammon, this terrible threat, dealt with in two verses. But that's not what the narrator wants us to see. The narrator wants us to see how this man treated his daughter. And so an emotional scene unfolds. Look at verses 34 to 36. Then Jephthah came to his home at Mizpah, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with tambourines and with dancers. Here's the emphasis. She was his only child. Saying it again, more words. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. Emphatic. And as soon as he saw her, he tore his clothes. First thing that exited his house. Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you have become the cause of great trouble to me, for I have opened my mouth to the Lord, and I cannot take back my vow, And she said to him, "My father, you have opened your mouth to the Lord. Do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, now that the Lord has avenged you on your enemies, on the Ammonites." Now, he is, of course, wrong. Can a man take back a rash vow? Yes. There are several places in the Old Testament that claim this. Here is one, Leviticus 5, verse 4 to 6. "Or if anyone utters with his lips a rash oath to do evil or to do good." So some people make promises to do bad things. Some people make promises to do good things. "If he makes a rash oath to do evil or to do good, any sort of rash oath that people swear, and it is hidden from him when he comes to know it, and he realizes his guilt in any of these. When he realizes his guilt in any of these, and he confesses the sin he has committed, he shall bring to the Lord as his compensation for the sin that he has committed a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat for a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for him for his sin." So this man, if he had realized what he had done, he could have said, "Lord, I have sinned in making a foolish vow. Please forgive me, and here's an offering to pay for my sins." He would have been forgiven. He could have taken back that promise. Why didn't he? Why did this man, who seems to know some of the political history of Israel, didn't know the basic laws of Israel concerning these matters? Because here is a man who doesn't have a deep biblical knowledge of things. He doesn't have a good view of God. He's not viewing God in terms of his holiness and his grace, but rather he's setting up this God to be like some sort of severe God who has no forgiveness or grace in him. There's this false consistency that's going on. Friends, this is a wonderful time to just think about the gospel. Do we believe in a God who is holy, who must punish sin? Do we believe in a God who does not lie, who cannot deny himself? And so we might have, on the one hand, an inkling of perhaps we should keep our word no matter what. But then this God, who is so holy, also is willing to save and be gracious towards sinners and provides a way for sin to be atoned for in Jesus Christ. That's the biblical picture of God, but that's not the picture that Jephthah had. He thought, "I better keep this promise or else. There's no way I can get out from under this. I don't have a God who's gracious. I don't have a God who forgives. I don't have a God who allows me to make mistakes. I've just got to keep my word." So he had a faulty view of God. At the time of the Reformation, many had to deal with the problems of wrong vows. The nuns and the monks, the priests, they all made vows of celibacy, never to marry. Vows of poverty, they owned nothing but what they earned in community and their cloisters. And vows of obedience, where they vowed to always obey the commandments of the Mother Superior or whoever was in charge, the abbot and so on. But when they studied the scriptures and the Reformation came about, Martin Luther and his wife, Katharina, They were once priests or monks and nuns, and they had to repent of their wrong vows. And they got married and had babies. They broke their vow of celibacy, or rather they repented of their vow of celibacy. And they did the right thing. It's one thing to keep your promise to represent a God who does not go back on his word. You know, isn't that one of the reasons why we keep our promises? We want to reflect that our God is a God of integrity by being people of integrity. It's good that you make a promise and that you strive to keep it. It's good, like Psalm 15 says, that a man will keep his word even to his own hurt. That's a good thing, because God keeps his word, and he takes the suffering upon himself that his promises might be fulfilled. There's a beautiful gospel thing going on there. But there's also a wrong way to keep promises, which can misrepresent God. What sort of view of God is Jephthah betraying by keeping his vow? What does Jephthah keeping his promise say about God? That he likes human sacrifice, just so that you keep a promise. Okay, doesn't go down so well, does it? Portrays him more like the Canaanites rather than the God of the scriptures. So this is worse than a rash vow. It's a pagan promise. It's not informed by who God is or his word. And unfortunately, Jephthah's daughter, who is portrayed as better than him, more noble than him in this portion, her faith is not very informed either. She also doesn't know that the Bible makes provision for forgiveness for these foolish oaths and vows. She helps him uphold this foolish promise by giving him permission to kill her. This nameless girl, we don't know her name, only asked that she might mourn her virginity. So there she goes away for 2 months. What a wonderful opportunity to reflect. What a wonderful opportunity to go back to the scriptures and just double check that you got it right the first time. Yeah, doesn't go there. Doesn't do it. He pushes through. And you'll notice that he is not memorialized, but she is, because she's the more noble. But look at verses 37 to 40. So she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Leave me alone 2 months that I may go up and down on the mountains and weep for my virginity, I and my companions." So he said, "Go." Then he sent her away for 2 months and she departed, she and her companions, and wept for her virginity on the mountains. And at the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did with her according to his vow that he had made. She had never known a man, and it became a custom in Israel. The daughters of Israel went year by year to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in the year. I think that also proves another reason. Why would you mourn someone who didn't die? She was put to death. The final point that we want to make is his peacekeeping. Jephthah's 6-year reign doesn't end there. First, there is the confrontation with Ephraim. Look at 12 verse 1. The men of Ephraim were called to arms and they crossed to Zaphon and said to Jephthah, "Why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites and did not call us to go with you? We will burn your house over you with fire." Now, just to keep you awake, when have Ephraim done this before? This is not the first time. Which other judge had to put up with this clan doing the exact same thing? Do you remember? Anyone remember? Gideon. Remember Gideon? He won with his 300 and they wanted part of the glory. They said almost the exact same thing to him, to Gideon. But compare Gideon now with Jephthah. Gideon was patient. Gideon downplayed his role. Gideon diffused the situation. Gideon at least brought about peace. Jephthah doesn't. He's not a peacekeeper. He doesn't strive for rest between brothers. Look at verses 2 and 3. And Jephthah said to them, "I and my people had a great dispute with the Ammonites, and when I called you, you did not save me from their hand. And when I saw that you would not save me, I took my life in my hand and crossed over against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me?" But look at verses 4 to 7. Then Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead struck Ephraim, listen to this, because they said, here's the personal insult, which was the spark to the to the tinder. "You are fugitives of Ephraim, you Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and Manasseh." It's an insult. You know, you're our offscourings. You're runaway Ephraimites. And the Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites. And when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, "Let me go over," the men of Gilead said to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" When he said, "No," they said to him, "Then say Shibboleth." And he said, "Sibboleth," for he could not pronounce it right. Then they seized him and slaughtered him at the fords of the Jordan. At that time, 42,000 of the Ephraimites fell. Jephthah judged Israel 6 years. Then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried in his city in Gilead. Does this sound like a man who's a peacekeeper or someone who is incredibly brutal? Jephthah is not a hero of the faith here. This is not commendable. So they weren't just defeated and sent on their way. In their escape, they were weeded out and executed. That's what we're seeing here. It's a horrible picture that's being portrayed. Now, when I think about Jephthah, and I mentioned this last week, when you will have noticed that just before Jephthah's reign, there was the two judges, Tola and Yair, and they were just given a quick reference with no expansion. And then after Jephthah's reign, we have that section in verses 8 to 15. We've got Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon given a mention, but no expansion. And you have to ask yourself the question, why is Jephthah the man that's put in the limelight? Why is his six-year reign, which is shorter than the seven-year reign of Ibzan, than the 10-year reign of Elon, why does his reign get expanded on when it's even shorter than the three that follow? Well, I think here's my opinion as to why I think that is. Remembering that the book is written as an apologetic for David, I think that's helpful. Because I want you to think of King Saul for a moment. I believe there is a deliberate parallel between Jephthah and Saul. Because what we have here in Jephthah is the people chose Jephthah. The people appointed him as leader, just as the people appointed Saul. Let's look at these parallels. Like Jephthah, Saul was chosen for the wrong reasons. He's a head taller than everyone else. Man, he's a good-looking guy. Let's get that guy. Not out of a trust in God, not seeking to do God's will, but he is representative of those things that we in our flesh latch onto, which appear to offer promise but do not deliver. On top of that, can anyone think of Saul making a rash vow? Everyone remember that? 1 Samuel 14, verse 24 to 27. While chasing the Philistines, he vowed that anyone who eats before his enemies are beaten should die. And who should reach out his hand to eat some honey? His son, Jonathan. What did Saul try to do to his son at that point? Tried to kill him. The men of his own army had to intervene and say, "Don't kill your son." Are you beginning to see the parallels? On top of that, when Jonathan tried to reason with his father Saul that David was a good guy, what did Saul try and do at that point? Try to kill him with a spear. Okay? I believe that there's a deliberate parallel. That's in 1 Samuel 20, verse 30. There's a parallel between Jephthah and Saul. Why Jephthah? Because Jephthah is just like Saul. And Saul was the king the people chose, just as Jephthah was. Godless leaders are harmful to the people of God. Here is the son of a prostitute who leads Israel into spiritual prostitution. Here is a fatherless man who fails in fatherhood himself. Jephthah causes Israel to cry out for a king just like David. Jephthah should make you want a better king than Saul, a king like David. Jephthah causes us to see our need for a king who will rule his people in justice, who will fight their wars for them in the proper fashion, who is righteous, who does not cause the people of God to turn upon each other in civil war, and who will, as Jesus has done, die in our place instead of putting us to death. Jephthah is the sort of leader which points us to our need for Jesus Christ. Let's pray.